The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 151, a paper entitled, Why Can't a Woman Be More Like a Man? Sherry L. Dew and the Subversion of Gender. The presenter, Hugo Olays, with a response by Margaret Toscano.
Welcome to session 151 of Sunstone Symposium. My name is Margaret Toscano. I am actually the respondent for this session, but since our chair didn't show up, I'm a take charge woman, and I will also introduce Hugo and myself. Our paper for this hour, the title is Why Can't a Woman Be More Like a Man? Sherry L. Dew and the Subversion of Gender. The presenter is Hugo Olays. Hugo is a third-generation Mormon from Argentina. He has a degree in literature and classics from the, I'll slaughter the Spanish here, but it's the Universidad Nacional de La Plata. He has a master's in Spanish from BYU. He also took graduate classes in Hispanic linguistics at Berkeley, California. And he has been working as a news editor for Sunstone Magazine for the last few years. And probably a lot of you know him most in that capacity. So Hugo will present his paper, and then I will be the respondent. As I said, my name is Margaret Toscano. I have a PhD in comparative literature from the University of Utah, where I also teach. I teach classics, Greek and Latin, and literature classes. I have also done a lot of writing in feminist theology, and so I will be pleased to respond to Hugo.
I can tell you the exact date when I discovered that Sherry Dew existed. It was Sunday, March 10, 2002, when I opened the Deseret News and found an article entitled Living the Unexpected Life. I hadn't even read the article when the photograph hit me like a board. It was a picture of Sherry Dew as a general authority. She was standing in Temple Square wearing a dark blazer, speaking on her cell phone with the Salt Lake Temple in the background. She was, it seemed to me, the ultimate 70 or the ultimate apostle, with a temporal job to do, represented by the cell phone, but also with a spiritual mission, represented by the temple. After reading the article, I concluded that definitely there's something about Sherry. BYU professor Eric Samuelson has called Sherry Dew the most prominent LDS single woman, an extraordinary woman. BYU students have described her as an amazing speaker, my hero, a beacon for womanhood. A Meridian magazine story calls her a rousing and righteous female voice. And recently, a returned missionary told her, in what he intended as a compliment, Sherry Dew, if I were just 40 years older, I would marry you. Sherry Dew is the president and CEO of a multimillion-dollar firm and a White House delegate to the UN on the Commission on the Status of Women. She has an office at Deseret Book and another at her church headquarters. By her own admission, she's a type A personality, a workaholic who often gets up before 4 a.m. and spends 1 hour each day at the stair stepper. I'm out of control, she confesses. I'm actually not happy unless I'm insanely busy. By her own account, Dew grew up working on a farm, driving huge grain trucks since age 13 and playing sports as often as she could. By age 12, Dew was a 5-foot, 10-inch tomboy who lived and breathed sports. Basketball was my sport of choice, she writes, but with a love for sweat socks, the pungent smell of deep heat ointment, and competition, I played whatever was in season, including fast-pitch softball. As a young girl, Dew had a lot of friends who were boys. She played ball with them, but they didn't date. According to her own account, by the time she went to BYU, she was a social mess, an absolute misfit. I would like to propose to you that the tomboy from Kansas has grown up to become, in terms of gender roles, the most intriguing figure of Mormonism. As the first female president and CEO of the Deseret Book, Dew might well be the most powerful woman in Mormonism since the day when Clare Middlemiss was the personal secretary of David O. McKay. Because of her prominent position in the Mormon hierarchy, Domingos with 70s apostles of the First Presidency, with a role that is both secular and spiritual, she is part of a hierarchy which, before her arrival, was exclusively male. But her immense popularity in Mormondom is due, above all, to her reputation as a vigorous, inspirational speaker. Between 1998 and 2001, she spoke 7 times at General Conference. She spoke at the funeral of Marjorie Hinckley. She has given scores of speeches to young people and to Relief Society women across the country and around the world. She has inspired and strengthened the testimony of hundreds of thousands. Sherry Dew is a staunch defender of traditional gender roles and the traditional family. She once publicly condemned a gay couple for marrying and adopting children and suggested a comparison between the rise of the gay rights movement and the rise of Hitler. On another occasion, she said that if she were Satan and wanted to thoroughly obliterate society, one of the things she would do is to confuse men and women about the divine nature of their distinctive roles. In an explanation of why the priesthood is for men and not for women, she said the following: "We know little about the reasons specific assignments were given to men and women. Because of that, the adversary seeks to create confusion about something that needs not be confusing." Today, I intend to problematize some of the assumptions people make about Sherry Dew by telling you of 3 ironies that I find in her life. These ironies subvert the expectations we have about traditional gender roles and the traditional families. First, despite her defense of traditional gender roles, Dew has a rhetorical style that is typically masculine. 2, even though she's single and has never had children, Dew advances a militantly traditionalist understanding of marriage and family structure. 3, despite her advocacy for traditional families, Dew seems to have built around her a network of friends who, I will argue, make up her own alternative family. The analysis of these 3 ironies will be the bulk of my paper. Irony number 1. Despite her staunch defense of traditional gender roles, a close examination of Sherry Dew's own rhetorical style subverts any expectation we may have about the way a woman should talk in church. When Sherry Dew speaks, the sweet, flowery style that in the past has characterized Mormon female speakers is all but gone. Dew preaches as no other LDS woman. When she speaks at firesides or devotionals, her rhetorical style is bold, aggressive, masculine. She is, one could say, the Mormon equivalent to Joyce Meyer. For those of you who don't have cable, Joyce Meyer is a masculine-looking woman who, dressed in designer suits, preaches from the Bible on 400 TV and 200 radio stations around the world. But even if you do not listen to Sherry Dew's talks, when you read them, you realize that Dew has, as no other Mormon woman, a penchant for quotes and stories set in time of war. She cites events from the Civil War and the Second World War. Some of her heroes are military figures, such as Churchill, Moroni, Hillaman, and the Stripling Warriors. But above all, Dew's rhetorical style is packed with military images and war metaphors. Our primordial spiritual valor indicated that we would have the courage and determination to do combat with the evil one during his heyday, says Dew. For her, Lucifer has turned the world into enemy-occupied territory. According to Dew, we must successfully negotiate this spiritual minefield called mortality. She sees the obedient children of God as protected by a force field. According to Dew, when Satan unleashed his anger against the Father, we were there, fighting on the side of truth. You may remember the movie God's Army. In that film, the sister missionaries stand on the sidelines during the final climactic speech when the mission president gives his great speech and tells the male missionaries that they are God's army. I don't think Sherry Dew would have approved of that scene. We have a cell phone somewhere? Dew sees women as vital part of the war against Satan. For Dew, mothers and women are the Lord's secret weapon. She says that the adversary has launched an all-out attack against womanhood. According to Dew, when young women engage in missionary work, they enlist in the army. Sisters, says Lou, this is a call to arms. This is a call to action. It's a call to arise, a call to arm ourselves with power and righteousness. For do we must arise as the women we were prepared to be during eons of premortal training. Yeah. Turn off your cell phones, please. I wonder, is Sue aware of her peculiar style of preaching? I think she has to be. At least on one occasion, a sister in the audience brought a critique of Du's militant message. I didn't like Sherry Du's remarks, said the letter, which ended up on Du's desk. I have struggled not to get overwhelmed by all the church requires. Telling me the Lord expects valiant women did not help me. I don't want to be incredible. I want to be me. Du later said that even though she agonized about the letter, she durst not to back away from what she taught on that day. Irony number two. One might expect that being a single woman at the top of the corporate ladder would prompt Du to take a less traditional view of gender roles, marriage, and family. But on the contrary, she has used her position to aggressively advance a reactionary understanding on all three accounts. Du doesn't have a traditional family, and yet she's engaged in a spiritual and rhetorical battle to defend the traditional family. This zeal has led Du to some peculiar situations. For instance, in October 2001, she gave a hyperbolic talk exalting the virtues of motherhood, which she defined as the essence of whom we are as women. During the same conference, Du gave another talk entitled, "It is not good for man or woman to be alone." Amazing as it may seem, in these two talks she never explicitly alludes to the fact that she is single nor to the fact that she has never had children. Instead, she makes obscure, cryptic references to her non-traditional status. Notice how she puts it in her talk, "It is not good for man or woman to be alone." Some of us encounter life circumstances that are less than ideal. I understand this. I personally deal with this. And yet, I must tell you that your understanding of this divine pattern will affect your marriage, your family, your ability to help build the kingdom, and your eternal life. In all justice to Sherry Du, I have to admit that in the version of this talk that she included in her most recent book, she does speak directly about her single status. I understand this in a very personal way, she adds to the quote above. For decades, I have pleaded with the Lord for the privilege of marrying and having a family. To this point, those prayers have not been answered in the way I wanted them to be. And she has been very open to talking about her single status in other contexts. But the version of the statement made at General Conference, the one that is translated into thousands of languages and reaches millions of women around the world, is at best cryptic. It seems to me that she missed a unique opportunity to strengthen, by sharing her own experience, all the single women in the church. I will now discuss Du's most controversial talk to date, the one she gave on February 2004 in Washington, D.C., for an event put together by a conservative religious coalition. For the first time, as far as I can tell, Du decided to address head-on the topic of same-sex marriage. She showed the audience a picture. An issue of Newsweek magazine, which included a full-color spread of a same-sex wedding. The picture depicted two young men getting married in the San Francisco City Hall while holding their adopted infant twin daughters in their arms. While showing the picture, Sherry Du stated, "This is hard for me to stomach. What kind of a chance do these girls have being raised in that kind of setting? What will their understanding of men and women, marriage and family be?" In the same speech, Sherry Du made statements that suggested a comparison between those who did nothing to oppose same-sex marriage and those who did nothing to oppose the rise of Hitler. That comparison sparked a controversy that gained Du national attention. But it was the "this is hard for me to stomach" statement that chiefly grabbed the attention of Affirmation, the National Organization of Gay and Lesbian Mormons. And unto Sherry at that time, one of the men in the picture happened to be himself a Mormon, a returned missionary from Idaho. The irony did not escape the leaders of Affirmation, and I assume it does not escape yours either. Sherry Du, who had never married or raised children, was condemning Eric Ethington for getting married and having children. That is, for doing, albeit in a not traditional way, what all Mormons are taught to do. At this point, the story takes an unexpected turn. So far, I have argued that Du is engaged in an aggressive defense of traditional roles. So aggressive, indeed, that forces her to assume a traditionally masculine role, thus subverting what she is trying to so ardently to defend. But there is another irony in the situation. When Sherry Du assumes a masculine role, she actually has an advantage over real men. Let me explain. On March 14, the leaders of Affirmation issued a statement condemning Du's remarks. 3 days later, Lee Davidson, a Deseret News reporter who had attended the Washington, D.C. event, wrote a passionate defense of Du, calling the Affirmation leaders bullies. "Long ago in junior high, some bullies were slagging and humiliating me," wrote Davidson. "Thankfully, a new kid in school jumped in to help me fight back. I later asked him why. He said it was simple. The fight had not been fair. I saw some unfair slagging this week at Sherry Du," he continued. "So I'm jumping into the fight because it isn't really fair." My point here is that because of her ultimate status as a woman, Du can not only assume an aggressive role traditionally reserved to men, her status as a woman allows her to also assume an archetypically feminine role. Only days after having been an aggressive crusader for the traditional family, Du became a damsel in distress, and Lee Davidson chivalrously jumped into the ring into her defense, thus reinforcing both his status as a man and her status as a woman. My irony number 3 is perhaps even more radical and results from asking the question, what does Sherry Du really exemplify in terms of family structure? The answer might be different from what you would expect. Here's a story from one of her books. "It has been nearly 3 years since I received one of those dreaded early morning phone calls. My younger brother Steve had suffered a massive heart attack and died during the night. During the next few days, many who loved Steve and his wife and children traveled to their home in Colorado. But it wasn't until after the funeral, when our family greeted friends who gathered at the cemetery, that I realized that 7 dear friends of mine had made the long trip from Salt Lake City to attend the service. What made their attendance all the more remarkable was that not one of them had ever met my brother. They had come to support me." Sherry Du goes on in the chapter to talk about the companionship of the Holy Ghost, but it is the anecdote about the funeral that really struck me. I ask myself the following question. Who makes a trip from Salt Lake City to Colorado for a funeral if they are not a direct relative and never met the deceased? Certainly the spouse of a relative or a partner or a significant other, but frankly, I cannot think of anyone else. Would it be too daring to conclude from this story that some of these 7 friends of Sherry Du could be acting as her own alternative family? Please understand that I'm not talking about sex or sexual orientation. What I am suggesting is that in many life situations, but especially when you are single, the social network of friends you build around you actually become your family. In chapter 4 of the same book, Du says, "As much as I love my biological family and depend upon them, life would seem empty were it not for my church family." But in the next page, in the same chapter, it becomes clear that it is not the church in general that constitutes Sherry Du's church family. Her family is a small group of close friends whom she met while carrying out assignments for the church. Du writes, "My dearest friends, with few exceptions, have come into my life as a result of our service together in the church. Most of these friends hail from backgrounds far different from mine. Most are married. Most have children. Most have grandchildren. We have laughed together and enjoyed each other's successes, and we have cried together and shared pain and disappointment. Through it all, I have come to find, gratefully, that marital status, background, and life circumstances have almost nothing to do with friendship. I can't imagine where I would be were it not for my friends, for the friends who have come into my life as a direct result of active participation in all levels of church service." In another talk, Du admits quite candidly that she has spent plenty of lonely nights and had plenty of times when she felt alone. There is, however, a crucial difference between spending lonely nights and having a lonely life. With her biological family scattered in different parts, Sherry Du has found a network of close friends who seem to act as her alternative family. Conclusions. My intent in this paper was to problematize Sherry Du's status in the light of her own rhetorical strategies and her staunch reaffirmation of traditional gender roles. Du is a woman, and yet she preaches with a masculine style that invokes powerful images of battles, soldiers, and wars. Du is single, she has never had children, and yet she exalts the importance of marriage and motherhood. My suggestion that Sherry Du has an alternative family of her own could have some important implications. I am happy for Du. I am happy that she has a small network of close friends from whom she draws companionship and support. We all have the potential to find friends, boyfriends, girlfriends, lovers, and partners. Sometimes we even get married. But perhaps we do not always get married because it's a commandment, or because we must replenish the earth, nor for any of the other reasons listed in the proclamation on the family. Perhaps we get married because as human beings we are naturally drawn to create bonds of love, trust, and companionship with one another. Such bonds may or may not include a sexual component. Such bonds may include two people or more than two people. Joseph Smith and Brigham Young can attest to that. Such bonds may include same-sex or opposite-sex relations. Such bonds are what make a family. The cover of Sherry Du's most recent book depicts a three-year-old girl hard at work, raking a little plot of land. It's a picture of Sherry Du. According to a biblical prophecy, someday the nations of the world will beat their swords into plowshares. But in a reversal of this millennial vision, Sherry Du has graduated from her little garden rake to a sharp sword. In one of her books, Du mentions another peasant girl who turned into a warrior, Joan of Arc. Joan of Arc was burnt at the stake for dressing like a man. Sherry Du is hailed across Mormondom for preaching like one. If Sherry Du could choose someone to marry, whom would she choose? In a recent BYU devotional, she stated, somewhat humorously, the name of her ideal husband, and it should come as no surprise, Captain Moroni. And yet, I ask myself the question, does she really want to be Captain Moroni's wife, or does she want to be Captain Moroni? Either way, Sherry Du's place is at the front lines, fighting against the devil, protecting the family, continuing a battle that she has been valiantly fighting since premortality. Thank you.
I want to thank Hugo for giving me the opportunity to respond to his very thought-provoking paper. On the one hand, I think when you first read Hugo's paper, it seems as though his argument is fairly straightforward. But the more I went through and thought about some of the issues that he raises, the more complexity I saw in his argument. And I think that this is extremely important because, in fact, I see the main contribution of Hugo's paper in the way that he points out the difference between Sherry Du's rhetoric and what she says about gender and what actually is there in her life. That there is a real tension between these two things, which he describes in terms of these three ironies about her life. Well, these ironies that deal with that tension between her rhetoric and this kind of straightforward, I mean, if you look at her rhetoric, you know, she says, you know, women should be women and men should be men and women have motherhood and men have priesthood. It's all very straightforward dichotomy. But as Hugo points out, when you look at her real life, it's much more complicated than that. And I think that in the way that Hugo does that is very important because it points out the complexity of gender as it actually manifests itself in the real lives of men and women inside and outside of the church. So I really thank him for that very important contribution. Now, as I talk about Sherry Du and Hugo's response to her, I have four areas that I want to focus on. The first one is I want to talk about the idea of people as embodiment of principles. And in particular, I want to address the question of whether or not Hugo's paper is an ad hominem attack. The second issue I want to talk about is the complexity of gender, and I would like to bring in some ideas of current gender theory that I think are really applicable to the issues that Hugo talks about. The third issue I want to talk about are double binds, the way that both men and women, especially in the church, are often put into these double binds where you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And then I want to, my last area that I want to talk about briefly is the issue of action versus words. We all hear the cliche you know, your actions speak louder than your words, and I want to play a little bit with that cliche. So those are the four areas I'm going to talk about, and I better keep track of my time here. Okay, so the first one, this idea of people being embodiments of principles. I know that some people could read Hugo's paper as a personal attack on Sherry Dew. I do not see the paper that way. I find it respectful of Sherry Dew, and I do not see it as an ad hominem attack. I think it's interesting in Mormon culture that we're very afraid of dealing with conflict. I have found this over the years as I have talked that, for example, in a couple of papers, I have critiqued speeches by President Hinckley. And when you do that, people automatically assume sometimes that you're simply, you don't like him, you're attacking him, you think he's a bad president. None of these are true for me. And in fact, in some ways, I would put President Hinckley up as, you know, among the three or four best presidents the LDS Church has had. I really respect him. And yet, I think that if we're going to grow spiritually or if we're going to really be, you know, thinking people, we have to be willing to critique ideas. And so the question is, you know, can you critique ideas separately from people? I guess my answer is yes and no. On the one hand, and in a sense, I guess this also plays with that old cliche, you know, can you love the sinner and hate the sin? Of course, I like complexity, so I always like to say yes and no to every answer, right? that can be true. And I think we have a problem here. I mean, on the one hand, you can say that Sherry Dew, and I see Hugo is treating her this way, he perceives that Sherry Dew functions as an icon for the church. I mean, she not only is a real person who gives speeches and she has her own life, but she is right now functioning as an icon for the church. She's become a sort of a figurehead or a symbol of the defender of the traditional family. Now, it's true that she's also a single woman, but she's also this icon. And I think it's important that we're able to talk about the interrelationship of how a person's ideas and then also how they function maybe as an icon in society. And so there is a way in which, you know, I think we can separate a person's ideas from their life and that you can say, well, I'm talking about their talk, I'm not talking about them. And yet in another way, these intertwine. And I think that we should be able to, as Hugo does, and I love what he does in his paper, where he's asserting that there's really a double discourse going on here. There's the discourse of her life, and there's the discourse of what she says in her speeches. And both of those are important. And it's important to talk and to critique, and I mean critique not in just the sense of a negative statement, but the intellectual, emotional, all of this kind of analysis of what the impact of this is. I received an email the other day from a friend of mine that I hadn't heard from for a long time. She confessed that she had Googled me and said that my most frequent internet description is, quote, excommunicated member of the LDS Church, or what she called an EMLDS for short, or my other epithet is excommunicated Mormon feminist, an EMF. Now, see, I confess that I don't like to be reduced to these epithets, which in a sense we could say that we are also doing on one level with Sherry Dew. I mean, I'm a lot more than just simply an EMLDS or what I can't remember my own, an EMLDS or an EMF, right? I'm much more than that. And, of course, I always hope that people will ask the question of, okay, yeah, she's an excommunicated Mormon feminist, but does that mean that she's not a believer? You know, I'm hoping that they'll ask questions like that. On the other hand, I'm naive if I don't recognize that whenever you become a public figure, and it's not like I'm that much of a public figure, but a little bit, then you are going to be, there are going to be labels put on you, and you have to deal with those. And I think it's important for us to talk about the meaning of that. You know, a person's words, what they come to represent as a public icon, and that person as an individual. I mean, I don't know Sherry Du, and certainly nothing that I'm saying today, or I don't think that Hugo was trying to say that we're making a judgment about her as an individual person, because I don't know her. I don't know her heart. I don't know anything about her. But we're talking about how she functions in Mormon culture. I thought it was interesting, and Hugo talked about this speech she made where she was critiquing gay people adopting a child. And she made some very strong public statements against gay marriage and gay relationships. On the other hand, and maybe you can remind me, Hugo, but there is a statement that she makes, and I'm not sure that it ever got in a public way. Hugo has it in one of his footnotes, so he didn't read it to you. But she has a little statement. Do you remember, Hugo, where that is, where she talks about gay people that she knows individually? But she made this statement where she said, I have a lot of gay friends, and I love them. I respect them as people. Again, she takes it to the individual level and says, well, you know, as individuals, I really can love gay people, but, you know, we've got to take a stand, she says, to defend the family. And my, you know, public statements against gays are not meant against them as individuals. And yet I would like to raise the question, is it really possible to dichotomize like that? I mean, if you attack gays having a child, isn't that going to be an attack on your personal friends on some level, I guess is my question. Okay, I want to move on now to my second area, which is the complexity of gender. And I have several areas here where I want to bring in some ideas about gender that currently in gender theory being talked about. The first idea is that gender, when we talk about gender, I mean, most of us think with gender male-female, right? But really, gender constructs in society are not simply about male versus female or even real women and men, but they are about the creation of dualities and hierarchies and how we set up power structures. That when we examine gender, we're really asking the question of how do we distribute power in society. Now, in terms of Sherry Du's, her persona and her words, and Hugo's analysis of her, I think that the most interesting thing here is that Sherry Du's rhetoric is very much in stark dichotomies. That if you look at her, almost all of her talks, she likes to pit good against evil. You know, you're either on the Lord's side or you're on the devil's side. You know, again, you've got to act like a man or act like a woman. She has these very stark dichotomies. And even in her use of war imagery, and I really like the fact that Hugo points out how much she likes war imagery, that if you think about it, that war imagery fits very well into that dichotomizing, that, you know, you're fighting good against evil. And, of course, dichotomies in this kind of stark contrast very much support her view of the traditional gender roles. On the other hand, as Hugo points out, if you look at her life itself, her life, even those of us that don't know her, doesn't fit into those stark dichotomies at all. And so I think it's very important for us to think about, you know, how do we use gender in the church, not just simply to keep men and women sort of in their own little roles, but how do we use it to support hierarchy? And certainly if you think about the speeches of Sherry Du, that they support the hierarchy, not just in terms of the division of male and female roles, but also in the sense of supporting the whole structure of the church. I thought it was also very interesting with Sherry Du that when she gives her talks in conference, she does not make a direct reference to being single. However, in her writings, she does. And that is such a curious thing to me, that on the one hand, it's not as though she won't say it, but you can ask the question, why won't she not say it in general conference? You know, what is the sort of hidden discourse there? Okay, my second point about gender is that when we look at gender and how gender is constructed in society, gender is never just simply, again, about male and female, and it's never just simply linear, because there are a lot of different factors that come into play. I mean, if we're talking about gender as power structures, then gender also brings in issues of race, ethnicity, age, beauty, talents, and so forth. So when we're looking at where somebody is on the hierarchy, it's not just, you know, in the church about male and female or motherhood and priesthood, but issues of race and class and beauty and talents come in. So one of the questions that I ask about Sherry Du is that, would she be likely to be as powerful as she is if she were not tall and white? You know, how do these other factors come into play? Or even her age group? You know, how do these relate to how we set up power structures? My third point about gender constructions is that, especially in Mormonism, we try to make gender look natural. And you see this very much in the discourse of Sherry Du, especially in some of the things that Hugo quoted. The idea that that we want to say, well, you know, again, you know, men are men and women are women, and that's just how it is. This is biological. This is natural. This is eternal gender. This is how it is. This is what we usually do with gender, and yet when we go down below the surface, it's really much more complicated than that. And, of course, if you think about, for example, even with the family, again, we often try to make the family seem as though it's just a natural, ordinary construct. We all know what it is. There's nothing kind of mysterious about it. And yet, if you look at the reality of how we define family, it becomes much more complicated. You know, it's never just that easy, straightforward thing that looks like from the surface that you would think from Sherry Du's talks. Even though Sherry Du's rhetoric is such that she likes to put things in these stark dichotomies, priesthood for men and motherhood for women, as soon as she gives examples, I think it's very interesting to me, that the lines begin to be fuzzy, as Hugo points out with her examples about her extended family. In her talk, Are We Not All Mothers?, which I find a very curious talk, because on the one hand, she's again reinforcing the traditional idea that women have this one role of nurturing and that they all should be mothers, and yet there's a subtext that's going on here at the same time. Because as soon as you ask the question, are we not all mothers, then you're saying, well, if you can say that you can be a mother without being a biological mother, then you're moving out from the idea of gender as simply being natural and into the idea that we can construct it in another way. And so you could even ask the question, can men have this mothering function? From the way that she treats it in that talk, I think you could say, yes, men could fulfill this mothering function. And so this talk that on the surface seems to simply be a reinforcement of the traditional values, there's a way in which the talk deconstructs itself. And I agree with Hugo that, in fact, I would say that not just in this tension between her life and her rhetoric is there this almost disconnect that deconstructs the things she's trying to support, but even in her talks themselves, there are often these little gaps that deconstruct the major theme that she's dealing with. In another one of her talks that Hugo mentioned, where it's called It's Not Good for Man or Woman to Be Alone, which, of course, again, there's a lot of irony here with her own life. But also, she does the typical priesthood-motherhood dichotomy, and yet there's one little line in there where she says, the fullness of the priesthood, and this is a quote, the fullness of the priesthood contained in the highest ordinances of the house of the Lord can only be received by a man and woman together. Well, I mean, it's a curious statement, and you say, well, in what way then do women share in the priesthood? But she never develops it. And yet here again, there's one of those gaps that deconstructs itself. My fourth point about gender is that when we look at gender constructs, one of the things that a power system always does is it tries to make power invisible. that just like it tries to make gender natural, it tries to make power and privileges invisible. So one of the ironies, another irony, I'll add another irony to Hugo's list that I see in Sherry Dew's life and talks, is that she puts forth marriage as the privileged and natural status. And yet, I think we have to ask the question, what privileges does Sherry Dew have by being single? If she weren't single, could she take the assertive stance that she does? Could she have the position of CEO as she does? Could she take, I mean, there are a lot of privileges that she gets by being single. I think this is an interesting thing in the church because we often think that, you know, since there is this big emphasis on marriage, that it's the married woman that has the privileged status. But I know in my own life I found out that as a married woman, you often are treated according to the priesthood status of your husband. That if, I mean, I married when I was like 26, and I found that it was much easier to have my sort of separate, independent identity as a single woman than as a married woman, because I immediately got classified as the wife of, treated as the priesthood status of my husband. And I would ask the question, why does she downplay her singleness? I mean, there's so many women in the church, I'm sure that if she talked about this more directly, it would be a comfort to them. Is it simply to better highlight the importance of marriage, or are there other things going on here? One other thing I want to note, which kind of takes us into the double binds, is that it would be impossible for a single man to occupy the high church position that Sherry Dew does. And so whereas, you know, we often think that, you know, males are completely privileged, I think the fact that she is a single woman can do things that a single man in the church could not. Finally, my last point about gender is that gender is always defined in relationship to. So if you think about in the church, the married state is defined in relationship to single. Male in relationship to is defined in relationship to female and so forth. And we often assume that those things like single, married, or male, female, or whatever, have a very simple relationship, but in reality they don't. I mean, for example, marriage is assumed to have this certain relationship to male and female. Marriage is usually linked with heterosexuality, but it can be a cover for homosexuality, as can singleness. It is usually assumed in the church that if a woman is not married, she has not had the right opportunity. Men, on the other hand, are often suspected of being gay if they are not married after a certain age. And yet we don't usually talk about the complexities of that. Okay, I want to, before I run out of time here, I only have a couple of minutes left, I want to talk about my two other points. First of all, the double binds. And I want to go back to Hugo's wonderful title, Why Can't a Woman Be More Like a Man? And of course, the title itself plays with the idea of how do we construct what male and female means. Usually women are very much in a double bind. They are encouraged to be submissive, and yet powerful women are often the only ones that really get what they want, even if they are seen as bitches. A woman's worth is defined by their marriage and motherhood status in the church, and yet, as I've pointed out, being a married stay-at-home mom sometimes means that you become invisible. I have a sister-in-law that complains about this. She's a stay-at-home mom with eight kids, and yet she says that, you know, the stay-at-home moms are not the ones that have a voice in the church. You're told to be that, but the double bind is that you lose your voice. In a way, Dew has positioned herself to escape both of the double binds. I mean, she has the visibility, and yet by downplaying her singleness and being the supporter of traditional marriage, she can be seen as, in a sense, she has the status of the married woman and the single woman together. Hugo says that Dew's rhetorical style is bold, aggressive, and masculine. And I think it's very ironic that, of course, that she's favoring how we traditionally define men. She says that men and women are meant to be complements, and yet her rhetorical style does not give the due to what has traditionally been the feminine. Would she be so powerful or well-liked if she took a different rhetorical stance? So I think that, as I said at the beginning, I see the contribution of Hugo's paper is that he points out the complexity of the way that gender really works in the church. And in spite of Du's simplistic gender polarities, her own life is more than that. Okay, finally, my last point. The cliche says that actions speak louder than words. And as a lover of words, I have always questioned this. I really believe that actions and words are equally powerful, which indeed I think we see in Sherry Du's life. Her words are very powerful, partly because she projects this image of the simple, straightforward choices of good and evil. A projection of a world that maybe we wish were true, but when you look at the real lives of people, it's not true at all. I want to say again, as I'm closing my remarks, that I do not mean any of my remarks as an attack on Sherry Du as a person. I know that for many people, she's a very positive role model, which I see as another irony, that she is, again, she promotes the traditional family, and yet her life itself gives inspiration to women who don't feel like that they fit. While I don't really like her talks that much myself, you know, I may like her as a person. And for me, one of the things, if I had sort of my ideal world, it would be a world where we could disagree about ideas and about how things should be, but that we could still have a community of charity where we can argue fiercely and yet still respect each other's positions in a way, in love. And unfortunately, even though I wish that, for example, you know, I could be in a place where I could even talk to Sherry Du, because as an excommunicated Mormon feminist, we are pitted as two women on this side of good and evil. I wish that that didn't have to be like that, but unfortunately it is. We have about almost 15 minutes for questions. If any of you have questions or comments, let me see if I can disengage this. But let's have you come up so everybody can hear your question. Okay.
And that is, Hugo, what do you see as the comparative level of Sherry Du's power when she moved out of the Relief Society General Assembly?
Good question. Levina asked whether or not Sherry Du's power in the church changed after she moved out of the Relief Society presidency.
It's a good question because it addresses the fact that I see Sherry Du as an apostle, that is, with both the managerial power and also with the spiritual power, right? And I don't think that since she has been released, her spiritual power has diminished, because she's the most popular speaker. She continues to speak all over the place. As a Deseret Book CEO and president, she started this program with women for women. They go on weekends. What is it called? Time Out for Women. And she goes and gives inspirational speeches all over the country. It's amazing the following that she continues to have. So, and yet, you know, yes, of course, maybe in the world, you know, if we think about the world church, yes, probably people who read her through the ensign probably won't read her anymore, not that much, since she doesn't speak anymore, probably in general conference. Yeah.
And a follow-up question, which you can also repeat.
Yeah.
And from being the spokesperson for the family when Marjorie Hinckley was dying.
Okay. The question is, how much of that power I think she draws from her closeness to President Hinckley as her biographer? I think that, how can I put this, that her romance with powerful church leaders goes long before President Hinckley. And of course, I don't know in detail except what I read about her. But from the time that she wrote, she became the presidential biography when she wrote actually President Benson's biography, Ezra Taft Benson. There's there a connection too. She being, you know, the girl from the farm where it's very hard. You have to work all day. And President Benson, you know, having been very connected with farming. I think there's some kind of connection there. So it goes beyond. I think it's a lot more complex than, you know, than simply saying it was her closeness to President Hinckley that allowed her to become such a high figure. The other part of the question about the funeral, I think the simpler explanation. Well, of course, one thing is that she's just, people think she's the best speaker in the. And let me tell you, when she speaks off the cuff, especially, she's like Joyce Meyer. She's so engaging, you know, and so energetic, you know, and people love her. And then, you know, she has the entertaining side, you know, people love her. But also the fact that she tells in one of her books the fact that in order to write about President Hinckley, she spent a lot of time with Marjorie, with Sister Hinckley. And I think that also qualifies her to speak at her funeral. Here there's another question.
This is really interesting, and my question is, typically when women take a very aggressive masculine stance, that's counter to gender stereotypes, and they're usually judged very harshly for doing that. One example is the Hopkins versus Price Waterhouse case, which was a woman who was very, very successful in the accounting field, brought in more business than anyone else, but she didn't wear enough makeup and she wasn't nice enough to her subordinates, and so she was not promoted to partner, and that case, discrimination case, so went to the Supreme Court and was found that gender stereotyping about her aggressive behavior was used to keep her from being promoted. In Sherry Dew's case, she's using an aggressive style, but somehow it has so supported the institution that there doesn't seem to be any backlash whatsoever to that style. Either of you can respond.
First, let me say a few things. I'm sure Margaret will have more intelligent things. She knows better gender theory and all that. Yes, I agree with you. What was I thinking? Were you all speaking? I thought I had a good thought. I will come back.
I absolutely agree with you. To me, that's one of the most fascinating things about her, and I don't know if it's a conscious strategy on her part, but certainly by talking so extensively in support of the traditional family and traditional roles. I mean, she's always talking about the roles of women and motherhood and so forth, that it seems to leave less of a place for anyone to criticize her. And it supports then her actions that she isn't criticized for being an aggressive woman at all. She's not perceived like that. And even in her war imagery, you know, because it's this male language where the figures are male, I see it as that she's, you know, deferring. It's almost as like the aggression is put out onto the male figures, and therefore she's not claiming it directly. It's not her. It's sort of like she's only speaking for these other males, and therefore she can't be criticized for it. And again, I don't know whether she's consciously thought about this, but I think it's a genius strategy. Maybe I should have developed this. You know, this is where I went wrong, maybe, as I didn't. I claim my own desire. One little comment, even about, I love the way Hugo Anz's talk when she said that, you know, she could marry somebody, it would be Captain Moroni. I mean, I see again, there's so much interest there. I agree with you, Hugo, that in a way she wants to be Captain Moroni. The sad thing I see about this for women in the church is that I think we often are not allowed to claim our own desire. We can't claim our power, we can't claim our desire, we can't claim our aggression. It has to be over here, you know, through my husband, through some other male figure.
Well, what I was going to say is that I think we should hail Sherry Dew for doing all those things rather than criticize her, right? Yes, there's another question. Would you like to come?
How does the job of CEO, which is a political economic job, CEO of Deseret Book,
Okay. The question is, how does her calling in the church and her job as CEO in Does Her Book relate? I think I kind of addressed that earlier on when I suggested that she actually she does both together. And that's where I see her as a man too, as an apostle, right? In the fact that I think the church leaders, the general authorities, are the ultimate. They have a temporal job, but they are also the spiritual leaders. So they have both functions. Excuse me? When did she become CEO? That's a good question. And now I don't remember exactly the days. But she was released a while ago from being in the Relief Society presidency. She stayed, though, as CEO and president of the Sarah Book.
She was CEO when she was called to the Relief Society. So that, you know, that's the sequence.
So both things happened at this, about the same time? She
About a year and a half apart. Actually, she was working in the publishing department. She was not CEO.
She was vice president before.
Okay. Yes, that's right.
Yes, she was vice president before, and she worked for them for a long time, I guess. Are there other questions? Yes, Mark.
What do you know about her personal management style?
Okay, the question is about her personal management style. One of the things that I think she's very drawn. She's again very masculine, very aggressive. One of the little stories that she tells is about this time when, you know, a while after arriving to her office, it was like 10 in the morning, and she had insulted and screamed at everyone at the reach of her voice, you know. And then she tells how she repented and went and asked for forgiveness. But I think that gives you a little hint that she's really a type A personality, a person that probably has a strong temperament and maybe hard to get along with. Now, you know, we all have our flaws, you know. In her case, that probably works well for her very demanding job. There's a question out there. When? You think she was already very aggressive? Okay. Ron is making a comment and suggesting that some people were fired when she assumed the highest position. This is for the tape. This is a correlated version of your comments. Too late. Another question or comment? Yes. Well, the question is, since she cannot date Captain Moroni, who does she date? I read several stories about, and I know the rumors because I was in some of the mailing lists that where I heard these rumors. I mean, when Elder Oaks became a widower, right? Immediately the rumors started. They had, you know, they were dating, and more than one occasion. There had been malicious rumors that she has been dating general authorities, you know. And in that article from the Desert News, she says that, well, all those rumors are false. Frankly, I don't know if she dates. I frankly don't know. Yes. Yeah, please.
I haven't thought about Sherry Dew until I came to this session, but I have a sister-in-law that is now the acting head director of the Peace Corps. And all her married life has been in leadership positions. And she's a very competitive person, very smart. And so she can do this. I suspect Sherry Dew is doing just what she wants, and she's a bright, smart person that knows how to get what she wants. And she knows if she were married, she couldn't do this. And she's very smart.
It's wonderful to think that competitive women can have a place in the church and they can reach their goals. I just wish that other competitive people like Margaret herself, you know, could also achieve high positions in the church.
He's written a lot of books, and she just calls him in one day. He told me that and said, "Pack everything up, you're out of here today." Didn't give him any warning. He had he just developed his own publishing company called Rivercraft. So he was devastated. And he told me the story that the general authority's son was coming in this weekend, and this caused the way he handled that.
Okay, I think we're about time. Thank you very much, everyone, and thank you, Margaret.